This is Margaret Whalen, Executive Director for the Arizona State Board of Optometry. This meeting is the February 3rd, 2023 board meeting, which began promptly at 8 a.m. Roll call was taken and a quorum of all seven members is present. Dr. Moffitt, Board President, reported on item B, conflicts of interest declaration, and there were none. Ms. Whalen performed roll call item C on the agenda, and we are currently in item D, President's Report, where Dr. Moffitt is reporting on the board's current audit.
They reported three had been implemented. Seven were in process. Nine had not yet been implemented per their review. And we went through each of these recommendations and their status. This will be reviewed in further detail later in the meeting, but just wanted to give an update of that. Agenda item E.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to let the record reflect that Ms. Galan and Mr. Hamed are at the meeting at 8:03 a.m.
Okay.
Good morning to the two of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Okay, agenda item E, review, discussion, and possible action on investigative reviews complaints regarding number one, Casey Guilford, OD, IR number 202307. Margaret, I was under the impression that the respondent and counsel may be present. Should we wait or proceed?
I believe counsel is here for the respondent and the patient is also present.
Okay. All right. As this is a virtual and telephonic meeting, I'd like everyone in attendance to please preface their comments with their name first. And when referring to the patient in this complaint, use initials only. I'd like to start with a board summary. If one of the board members would like to summarize the complaint. I think I could summarize it in this instance. So, let's see, on December 14th, 2021, Dr. Guilford saw patient TM for an eye infection in the left eye. She had a mucopurulent discharge in the left eye that had been treated for 10 days already by her PCP or APCP with Polytrim on a 3-times-a-day schedule. Patient also had a history of a nasal lacrimal duct obstruction in that left eye that had been diagnosed in Dr. Guilford's office, so she did have access to the records. By Dr. Graham, I think who was a colleague. Dr. Guilford did not culture the discharge, but did tell the patient that this was textbook gonorrhea. Patient was prescribed Ocuflox 4 times a day and a Z-Pak, and the patient subsequently improved. Patient TM, if you would like to take an opportunity to tell us about your experience, this is your opportunity to describe the incident.
I first went to her. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I first went to her in 2020 and she told me I needed to see a plastic surgeon. As a lay person, I didn't understand that because I didn't even know that that was a thing where you can go to a plastic surgeon for your eyes. But I went to see Dr. Grant after visiting my PCP, who informed me that she thought I should. And I went to see him and he explained the situation and the procedure to me in a way which I understood. And at that time, he told me that I would get frequent eye infections. And if that started to happen, then I would need to have surgery. So I had the first eye infection December 21. And I went to my PCP to have it treated. And I got some antibiotics and they did not work. And I called to get an appointment for the eye doctor. And I was trying to get an appointment for the Sun City location. and they said they didn't have anything available. The only place available was the Glendale location. And I thought, well, it's pretty probably slim to none that I would get that same doctor again. I had no idea she was the only doctor there at the time. So when I went to see her, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and I was the only one there. And right before she came at the office, another lady came, and she took her first, and I was okay with that. And then when that one left, another one had came, and she took tried to take that one, but the lady said, no, she was next. And she was like, oh, okay. So I went in, and she looked at my eye, and she was like, ew, that's nasty. And I said, well, can I have a Kleenex to wipe it? And she gave me one. And she looked in my eyes with the machines, and then she left out the room, and she stayed gone about 10 minutes, and she came back, and she just spit it out with force. You have gonorrhea. And I was like, what? Yeah, that's what I'm going with. And I said, well, how is that possible when I haven't had sex in years? And she said, that's what I'm going with. So I felt like somebody had punched me in my gut. That really, really, really floored me. And I had no idea that there was such a thing as gonorrhea of the eye. So I went home and did some research, and I found out that there is such a thing. And the only way to diagnose it is to do an eye culture, which she did not do. So when I came back for my follow-up two or three days later, I asked her, how did she come to that diagnosis? And she said, it's pretty textbook. And I said, are all bacterial infections textbook? And she said, that's what I'm going with. So I came home, you know, and I tried to get past it, but it hurt me so bad that someone would say something like that for absolutely no reason. And I started getting depressed. Someone from the state board called me. I don't know if it was them or not, but my telephone said State Board of Arizona. And the person on the phone told me they were from State Board of Arizona. And they told me they had received a complaint about the incident, and they were asking me, you know, if I had anything I wanted to add to the complaint. And they was telling me that they take this very serious and they would be in touch. But no one ever got in touch with me, and I didn't know who would have filed a complaint other than myself. I sent the complaint to Dr. Perkins, and I also sent it to the office manager at the Glendale location. So I assume one of them maybe had put the complaint in. So I called the state to find out what was the status of the case, and they told me they didn't have a complaint. And then after further, you know, talking to the person, they said, oh, if she's an optometrist, then we have a different board for them. And they gave me the information for that board. And I called them, and they said they didn't have a complaint on file. So I filed one. I don't know who initiated the supposed other complaint because it wasn't me. And they didn't find one. So I assume one wasn't filed. So I don't know where that came from, but I filed the complaint and I feel like what she did was wrong. I feel like it was deliberate. I feel like it was irresponsible and it hurt me very bad to the point where I had to seek therapy, which I am presently in and having lots of issues with the payment of the therapy. And also it made me have a very strong distrust for doctors in Arizona because I feel like the science is in place to be used. And if she would have done the culture, she would have found a different answer. And even after I told her that I had not had sex in years, she had an opportunity at that point to say, well, let me just do this eye culture so that we could make sure. But she did not do that. And I was damaged and I'm still damaged by it. I'm trying every day to get past it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is the respondent here, or would counsel like to speak on her behalf?
I would like to speak on Dr. Guilford's behalf. My name is Megan Gailey. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Guilford. She has provided a response to the complaint, which I think is very detailed regarding her position as to the interactions with this patient. It is unfortunate. I think that there was a miscommunication between the patient and the provider in this type of scenario, which happens more frequently than I think most providers like to admit at times. I think that Dr. Guilford went through the different scenarios in her mind, trying to ascertain what could be the underlying cause or the bacteria for the infection that this patient presented with in order to come up with a treatment plan to make sure that her vision wasn't impacted due to the infection. As we all know, endophthalmitis is a very serious condition if it progresses, if someone has that serious type of infection. So when dealing with ocular infections, you want to make sure that they're adequately and appropriately treated. In this particular scenario, she came up with a different type of antibiotic regimen. And a couple of days later, the patient had much improvement from the infection. And at that point, because the antibiotics were working, she didn't see the need to further culture the infection. Dr. Guilford feels terrible that the patient interpreted her statements the way she did. She is upset that it came to this type of level. She tries her best to help educate her patients and help them with the process and explain what's going on, just like with a blocked tear duct and referring the patient to a plastic surgeon to have that taken care of to prevent future infections, which is commonly known with tear duct blockages. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions the board members may have. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. So I think we'll open this up. That'll conclude comments then from counsel and the patient, and we'll open this up for board discussion. And then if we have any questions, we'll ask you directly during our discussion. Would anyone like to comment? Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, so this is Dr. Carpenter. I'd be happy to comment. You know, in listening to our patient TM and then reading her statement, certainly her level of distress was apparent with the presumed diagnosis that was put forth. So my heart goes out to her and all the anguish that this has caused her. And I think it does underscore the importance for us as providers to make sure that we do communicate, that we show empathy and just be able to communicate our suspicions, but also be able to tell I guess not deal necessarily with absolutes, but I will say that the care she received in both cases with the tear duct, but then also the eye infection, she received great care. So I don't see any violations there. But again, just a reminder of the importance of empathy and communication and making sure the patient understands and has adequate time to, you know, to discuss the issues.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Other members' comments? Dr.
Yes,
Cohen?
Hi, this is Steve Cohen. I had a question for a patient TM. with the discussion about the tear duct issue, you said that the doctor said the plastic surgeon will explain to you because you were perplexed about plastic surgery because you were thinking about the typical plastic surgery. And then with the issue of coming to the diagnosis of gonorrhea, is it that it may have been explained in a way that wasn't as clear, or do you feel it was not explained in either case to you at all as to why the suspicion was referral to the plastic surgeon and then secondly with the gonorrhea?
Well, she did not explain to me why I needed to see a plastic surgeon. She just said, you need to see one. And had the referral for me to see one. And I asked her, why did I need to see one? And she said, they'll tell you. And that's what made me not want to go to see the plastic surgeon, because I didn't know a reason why I should see one. Mm-hmm. And if it would have been explained to me, then I would have known. And after Dr. Grant explained everything to me about what he do as a plastic surgeon, then I understood. And he also explained to me that I would get infections in my eyes and something would have to be done about it. So that was the first infection that I got, was in December 21, and I saw Dr. Grant in October of 2020, and I have not had another infection since. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, ma'am, it does. This is Dr. Cohen again. The comment that I'd like to make is that it appears, I agree, Dr. Carpenter, it appears if the care was good, and it is, and certainly evidenced by the fact that there was improvement with the treatment regimen she came on, where the treatment regimen by the primary care physician was unsuccessful. When I lecture to students and new recent graduates, I always tell them that we go into the exam room thinking that answering the question, what is the most important question we answer? What's the diagnosis and what's the treatment? And I always tell them the most important question we answer is why, because in order to get a collaborative effort with the patient and for a patient to leave comfortable and understanding what's going on, we have to explain why we came up with that diagnosis and why we came up with that treatment plan. And that seems to be the area that's lacking. So I don't know whether it rises to any violation of the statutes, but I certainly feel for patient TM, because I can see where that would be very, very disturbing. And I don't know if there's some comment that the state board could make about reminding practitioners. Dr. Carpenter said that the communication element is so critical and part of the care. I'm pleased that she's doing better and hasn't needed a surgery, and so far hasn't been necessary. But I'm really concerned about the communication and the coming up with what is a very, very stigmatized diagnosis without having gotten confirmation through a culture.
Thank you. Other comments?
This is Dr. Mastoris. I just wanted to say that I also feel for the patient. And after hearing all the discussions, I agree with Dr. Cohen that there's possibly a lack of communication and understanding, you know, the process. And as she got better, that's great. But we just need the doctors to understand how important it is to communicate effectively. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to make a few comments too. I'm not a closing discussion, but I thought that there were a few things that needed at least to be stated that I thought were appropriate with regard to this discussion. So one, clearly you cannot diagnose gonorrhea without a culture. And Dr. Guilford knows that. She shouldn't have said gonorrhea in that conversation, in my opinion, without a culture. We see bacterial conjunctivitis all of the time. I don't say this is MRSA. This is, you know, Neisseria. I don't say it's any of those things because you cannot diagnose what bacterium is present without a culture. You have to grow it in a lab. You have to have confirmed laboratory diagnosis. It's an inappropriate comment to make. And so patient TM, just for your information, the record does not say you had gonorrhea. The record actually just says a bacterial conjunctivitis. So this may have been a conversation that the two of you had, but it's not in your record that way. A couple of other comments. Dr. Guilford brought up that if this was a resistant infection, with the PCP putting her on Polytrim three times a day, it was under treated at three times a day. Polytrim is a five times a day. It's a Q3H regimen. So it makes sense that it didn't get better under those conditions. Also, I think the most likely diagnosis was a dacryocystitis from the nasolacrimal duct obstruction. You know, and that was a part of the history that Dr. Guilford had in the office, that this patient had a nasolacrimal duct obstruction. If it was indeed dacryocystitis, it wouldn't have responded to a topical antibiotic. You have to use an oral antibiotic in conjunction with the topical to get resolution. And that's actually what happened in this case. And then the patient got better. But the diagnosis in the record is not incorrect. It says bacterial conjunctivitis. You clearly had a bacterial conjunctivitis. You may just have also had a dacryocystitis at the same time. But that explains the lack of resolution with the previous treatment and the previous doctor. Also, technically, there is no violation that I see here of the Optometric Practice Act. It was just really poorly handled. And I believe the doctor was inarticulate in the way she expressed herself to you. And I hope that she's probably learned a lesson about saying something like this out loud with absolutely no clinical evidence other than her impression of what it looks like. That's all that I can gather as far as this goes. But there's a long list of differential diagnoses in this presentation without doing the culture, which she knows she should have done a culture if she wanted to say anything like that. And probably should have, if she suspected gonorrhea, she probably should have done the culture so she could have told the patient definitively, this is gonorrhea, you need to also tell potential other partners, et cetera, this kind of thing. So those were the things that I think are important. I think Dr. Guilford needs to take that away from this experience. I'm hoping in this case, patient TM, that you at least understand that doctors make mistakes too. They're people. Sometimes they speak before they think something through entirely. And that's what I think happened in this case. And it doesn't reflect on you or what happened, how you presented. It reflects on her. And that would be what I would try to take away from it if I were in your shoes. But when we review the record, the diagnosis, the treatment plan, it was handled correctly. It just was not articulated to you correctly. And so those are my thoughts. Dr. Brown or Ms. Galan, Mr. Hamed, do you have any comments regarding this?
Bob Brown here, and I agree with all that's been said so far.
Okay, Ms. Galan?
I think you summed it up rather nicely, probably better than I could have. So, I definitely agree with that. I think that this could have been handled a lot, a much better way, but I don't see any violation that occurred. I do think it should have been handled better though.
Mr. Hamad, comments?
Sure. I'll take the last word on this. I'm sorry, patient TM, that you went through this. My apologies. I feel that, Dr. Guilford could have handled it better, like everyone else has said, and that to her attorney, Ms. Gailey, let this kind of form as an informal warning, if you will, about that. Please let your client know as well, actually. I mean, the care, I wouldn't say the care was the greatest. I think the care was below great or good, but I don't think it was the worst care, substandard by any sort at all, whatever. But it was just bad, poor communication, which as a result brought us to this point here today all around and things. And hopefully from this, Dr. Guilford will learn from this.
Okay. Margaret, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I would actually encourage you to consider a letter of concern in this case. The letter of concern is a great tool, as you know, and I've said this before. When there are no specific findings of violation, the letter of concern is when the board feels like there are possible violations. In this case, our unprofessional conduct law under ARS 32-1701, number 8, is very lengthy and specific. And I think that a possible letter of concern for lack of communication, lack of appropriate communication, would be in order, or possibly even for not performing the proper testing during the communication with the patient. So as you had mentioned, Dr. Moffitt, you know, kind of telling the patient one thing but not really knowing because there was no testing done doesn't seem really appropriate as far as communication goes. So again, I'm just asking the board to, for a moment, just consider a letter of concern for the lack of appropriate or proper communication in this case.
Okay, and I want to state for the record, too, that we see bacterial conjunctivitis all the time and don't culture it. So it's not really a standard of care that you would always take a culture. It's just that if you're going to say that it is this particular diagnosis, as opposed to the more general broad classification of bacterial conjunctivitis, you would have to have taken a culture. So I do take cultures sometimes, but I don't actually use the resources on every bacterial conjunctivitis because, generally speaking, they respond to treatment. Broad-spectrum antibiotics treat all sorts of bacteria. You don't always have to know the bacteria. So I wouldn't actually say that there is any violation of a standard protocol for care, but it's more about the communication with the patient, and you certainly don't verbalize, which she did not put in the record, gonorrhea. I'll say it again for the patient's benefit. It is not written in the record that she diagnosed gonorrhea. It's just apparently a conversation the two of you had. But she did not put that in the record. She just put bacterial conjunctivitis. So those are my thoughts on that. But I agree, poor patient communication. And so I would leave it open to the board. Do we want to send a letter of concern, or are we comfortable that we've discussed it and sent the message via her attorney? Any thoughts? Any motions?
Dr. Brown here, I don't see a need for a letter of concern. I think that our discussion here today and addresses that.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. So then with the discussion here with the respondent not present, are we then relying upon her able attorney who is here to convey what our concerns are? So there's a way formally for her to understand that we feel that was that part was mishandled?
I believe so. I'm under the impression Ms. Gailey is going to tell her client about what transpired here, but Ms. Gailey, would you like to respond?
I have taken copious notes of all the comments made by the members of the board, and it is my intention to have a very concrete conversation with my client and inform her of the concerns expressed by the board regarding her communication style with this particular patient.
Okay.
Dr. Cohen, thank you.
You're welcome.
Margaret.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I also, in the dismissal, if it does get dismissed, excuse me, in the whatever letter we send to the respondent, I put the link for the audio and video so that they can listen to their case since they were not here.
Thank you. Other thoughts? So this is open to the board, and if anyone wants to make a motion, they can put it in their motion that they want to send a letter of concern, or they can dismiss it in their motion, and then we can vote on it.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I'd like to first, I'd like to thank patient TM for sharing the difficult story and wish her well, but I'd like to make a motion that there is no violation of any of the statutes in this case.
And to dismiss, Dr. Cohen?
Yes, and to dismiss. Thank you.
Is there a second?
I'll second it. This is Diva Aguilon.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
I would like to say something.
I'm sorry, I don't know, Margaret, is this appropriate? Or Mona, can we have patient discuss at this time? I think this is only board discussion, patient DM.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry. And so any further discussion regarding our motion? Okay. So we've had a motion to dismiss as there is no violation of the Optometric Practice Act and a second. Now we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote? It's either aye or the motion.
I vote aye.
Okay, thank you. And then Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0. We'll move on to our next agenda item here, agenda item F. Review, discussion, and possible action regarding compliance, revision, or termination of probationary order. This is regarding number one, Kelsey Stevens OD related to IR number 202213. We've received a quarterly report for December. I didn't see the January report come in. Margaret, was that added to the materials?
No, it was never received.
Okay. Are there any comments from the board members regarding the auditor's report for Dr. Stevens? Okay, so no comments. Would someone like to make a motion to either accept or reject the auditor's report?
Dr. Brown, I move that we accept the report.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second?
This is Dr. Cohn. I'll second that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right, so we'll vote. We've had a motion to accept Dr. Stevens' auditor's report regarding, related to IR number 202213. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0.
This is Dr. Cohn. May I ask one quick question? Do we know where Dr. Stevens is in the process when completion is expected? I don't recall that.
Margaret, do you have the answer to that?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. Dr. Cohen, members of the board, she is due to complete the probationary period in April, so I am still just waiting for her additional continuing education that was required under the order, and then we'll have a closeout of the final reports.
This is Dr. Cohen. Thank you, Ms. Whalen.
My pleasure.
Okay, moving on to agenda item G, executive director approval of new license applications pursuant to ARS 32-3123. Margaret has a list here of A through K of new licensees. Agenda item H, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license applications awaiting fingerprint reports. Request for board approval pursuant to ARS 32-1730. So we have a list of 1 through 9 there of applicants, and we are awaiting fingerprint reports, which apparently are backlogged for multiple months. Margaret, do you want to say anything about this?
I do. Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. Again, we do have the statutory authority to approve without receipt of the actual report from DPS. The reason that we are utilizing it at this moment and in the past few months is because Department of Public Safety and FBI reporting is terribly behind. I contacted DPS yesterday for a status update on all these outstanding, and they are actually only processing fingerprint cards from November 1st. Right now. So as most of these were submitted way after that, we would be waiting quite a bit of time. And we do have our statutory timeframes to meet as well. So that is why I'm asking the board to please approve these. And the reason also that these are on here, if there's any confusion, the statute does have language that says if the board has no reason to believe that there are any issues. And that reason actually stems from the questions that are answered on the application, where it asks if there's ever been any convictions or anything like that. If the applicant answers no, then that would be considered the reason that the board does not have any issue to believe that there could be a fingerprint report.
And then if the fingerprint report comes back with a finding, you'll bring it back in front of the board, correct?
Yes. So if the applicant has paid the license fee and becomes licensed in the interim, then it would be a complaint that gets opened, then it would be processed just like a regular complaint.
Okay.
Yes.
Any discussion from the board members regarding these applicants and approving them before the completion of the DPS report? Would anyone like to make a motion? Oh, go ahead.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohn. I'd like to make a motion that these applicants are accepted for licensure at this time.
Thank you. Is there a
this
second?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll second that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, so we've had a motion to approve these licensees and a second. Let's vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Okay. Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0. Agenda item I, review, discussion, and possible action of approval, on approval, excuse me, of Testing Center for Proctoring of Jurisprudence Exam pursuant to AAC R4-21-203C. So we have three potential testing centers listed, Collin College, Florida Atlantic University, Hinsdale Public Library. Are there any concerns regarding approval of these testing sites for the jurisprudence exam? I hear nothing. Would someone like to make a motion?
Dr. Brown, I'd like to move that we accept these testing centers.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Sammy Hamed, I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, so we'll vote on accepting these three sites as new jurisprudence testing exam centers. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0. Agenda item J, review, discussion, and possible action regarding sunset review, agency continuation, and follow-up audit report. Starting with number one, SB 1075, the optometry board continuation. Margaret, did you want to give any background to this?
Yes, thank you, Madam President, members of the board. This is a standard language continuation bill for an agency who's up for elimination, which all of us are every 8 years. We are one of the last agencies that's under the old 10-year timeframe. That was lowered to 8 years a few years ago. The Committee of Reference met I guess appreciated our audit report and did vote to move the agency forward and with a 6-year term. I'm not sure why it's only 6 years instead of 8 years, but I do intend to fight for the 8 years because, as you can see, it's been a lot of work for the audit, and I think the agency is running pretty efficiently in light of whatever administrative findings there were. So again, and don't be scared by the termination language in there. That is very standard because that's required for the agency to have its time frame. So every agency will show like a renewal date of continuation and then a termination date. And all that means is if the agency somehow doesn't pass the audit or something happens, it can automatically terminate without a big legislative process.
Okay. Any other questions or comments regarding SB 1075? Okay. So J2, the audit report, follow-up dated 1/17/2023. Margaret, I thought I'd let you, if you wanted to go through this in any detail. I touched on it in the president's report, but if you wanted to review it in any detail.
Thank you, Dr. Moffitt. I didn't specifically. I appreciate your report. You and I are on the same page when it comes to the audit, and I think I have reported to the board. The follow-up audit was positive in my mind, and a lot of the items that were in transition or in progress are just that. I feel like some of them are probably met, but there's certain criteria for what the auditors consider met and what the agency would consider to be met. But as you recall, hopefully a lot of the findings were just administrative, you know, stuff that's in my head. I need to get on paper, like phone policies, desk procedures, manuals for the e-licensing, things that would allow the agency to run smoothly should something happened to me or the other staff, or we have a, you know, big change, to the state. So, I'm diligently working on those and, hope to be in compliance at our 18-month follow-up. That'll be the next follow-up. This was the 6-month follow-up. So, I think the report to the legislature was very fair, from the auditors. And I think that's why, you know, we were continued at least for the 6 years for the time being. So. I'm pleased with the progress that we've made, and some of the progress is being held up because I am waiting on other people. I reached out to the Department of Administration, to the Asset Division, which is the IT people, to get some programming done to our website for the disciplinary actions that are required to be posted and things like that. So we're just moving forward and hopefully expeditiously, and I would like to be definitely in compliance with the audit sooner rather than later. So that's my plan.
Okay. I agree with how you summarized that. That's my impression also. And then let's see here. SB 1227, State Board of Optometry proposed statutory changes cleanup. So I think there were pages 1-11 that we had reviewed previously, the language. Did everyone get a chance to look through that again? Any comments from the board members regarding the language in there?
Madam President, if I may. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. So that is the official bill, 1227, for the statutory changes and cleanup that we had asked for. And I do know that on page 11, I believe, somehow inadvertently or didn't remember that the email address was in there as a public requirement. So I'll make sure to try and amend that before it gets too far in the legislative process. We will have time, should there be any changes that the board sees today or in the future, if you email me anything, because I believe the bill has only had a second read. So we'll have a little bit of time to amend something should we need to. There was a little bit of a development about that bill. I kind of expected it to just be innocuous and kind of go through the process, but ophthalmology has decided that the change to our definition of surgery looks like we're going to plan on doing surgery now. So I just wanted to give you a heads up. I completely disagree with that. The language was simply outdated. As you recall, when we had the discussion at our board meetings, and they can certainly listen to those discussions as well, that we are not asking for any scope expansion, any new surgery or anything like that. This is really just an update of the language. So I was contacted by the lobbyist for the AZOA, the Arizona Optometric Association, and the lobbyist from ophthalmology would like to have a meeting. So I will be gracious and give them a meeting. I only say it that way because I don't feel like we have to meet because we have not changed our scope. So, but to clear the air, I will definitely meet with the lobbyists for both parties and see if we can't just quash any concerns that they have. So yeah. Other than that, I do expect the bill to kind of go through quietly because, again, this was just language cleanup. There isn't any scope expansion. So.
I wouldn't mind being present for that meeting with the lobbyist if you don't mind.
Yes, ma'am. I certainly will. I don't have a date yet. I offered up 3 dates next week. I think it'll be a Zoom meeting, so I'll let you know, Dr. Moffitt.
Okay.
Margaret, who's the this is Tammy Hobby. Question for you. Who's the lobbyist for the board?
The board does not have a lobbyist. It's just me, I guess.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm the registered lobbyist for the board. As you probably recall, Mr. Hamed, that a few years ago, Governor Ducey had passed a law prohibiting state agencies from hiring outside lobbyists.
I do remember that. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's just me. But the lobbyist for the Arizona Optometric Association is Don Isaacson.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you, Madam President.
Okay. Agenda item K, review, discussion, and possible action regarding proposed legislation to change the expiration date of eyeglass prescriptions to 2 years. Number one, SB 1014. So I think it was Mr. Kavanaugh, a legislator that has a proposed legislation change that would make prescriptions a two-year expiration date instead of 1 year. And this is on our agenda to see if we had any comments regarding this and if the board wanted to take any kind of position, whether that's for, against, or neutral position with regard to this bill. Oh, Margaret.
Thank you, Madam President. Could I just give a little preemptory explanation or discussion talking points? Would that be appropriate?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. So in case you haven't had a chance to read the bill, it would amend 32.1754 of our statutes. Actually, I'm sorry, it wouldn't amend, it would add a section. And the language is simple, it's one sentence. A prescription for ophthalmic lenses other than contact lenses is valid for 2 years, unless otherwise specified by the prescribing optometrist. I encourage the board to really consider the impact that having a specific date of expiration in the law versus how it's currently written. I think the way it's currently written, it says the prescription must include an issue date and an expiration date. That is what gives you the authority based on a case by case, person by person, however you want to say it, based on the patient, their ocular health. So some of the issues that I have when I saw the bill at first is that the AOA clinical guidelines for adults already allows for a two-year frequency of prescription, and that's based on what they feel is the frequency of exams for someone who is in good ocular health. So again, that gives you the authority as the optometrist to determine the patient sitting in your chair, they have good health of their eyes, can they have a two-year prescription or 18 months? You could do that. The standard of practice in the industry across the country does not match that, but that's kind of how it's been. So I'm not going to really address that because it's not my place to say. But just as an aside, I mean, honestly, that standard practice is a little bit outside the guidelines of the AOA clinical guidelines. I think from the perspective of public protection and according to the guidelines, you know, you have that authority already. So changing it and putting it in statute just seems redundant. And then there's also pediatric guidelines set forth by the AOA. So that is something for people with children. I have a table. Let me just see if I could share that real quick with you guys, because I think it's important that it be addressed as well, because there isn't just like a one-size-fits-all. When they talk about a two-year prescription, it doesn't address children. Can you all see this box, the table right here? So this is the recommended eye exams set forth by the AOA for pediatrics. So again, doing a standard or overall two-year time frame may affect how somebody would do a pediatric prescription. And then lastly, and I think this is kind of a big one, especially for you as practitioners, I feel like changing the prescription date to 2 years may result in a change to the way insurances pay or allow for eye exams and related benefits, as well as frequency of coverage for those who may not qualify for a longer term prescription. So, you know, sorry. So think about if, you know, a patient isn't eligible, let's say, based on their ocular health for a 2 year prescription. But now the insurance companies have jumped on that bandwagon because it's 2 years. That could be really detrimental to the care of that patient who may not be able to afford an annual eye exam without their insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So, as you can tell, I'm not a big fan of this particular bill. So I would ask the board to just consider whatever you feel about the bill and either, and to take a position on it, because currently I'm logged in, on behalf of the board as neutral, because I had not spoken to you yet. But the board can certainly remain neutral. They can, oppose the bill or they can support the bill. So But I do think the board should take a position of some kind. So when you all are having your discussion, if you'll just keep that in mind, I would certainly appreciate it.
Okay. Anyone on the board like to state their position?
Yes, hi, this is Dr. Cohen. Thank you, Margaret, for that excellent summation. The part that I keep lurching onto is the unless determined otherwise. So it still gives us the discretion. But if the industry standards now say 2 years and they're proposing 2 years, I can see where that would quickly become 2 years as the standard of care. Even if it gives us the discretion to say otherwise, then that could be, that'll be the part that'll be emphasized. The reality of it is if we do believe that once a year is reasonable for preventative eye care, then many patients come in who don't need a change in prescription in 1 year, but we've had the opportunity to confirm that their ocular health and general health is in good shape. So I'd rather not see that because I believe, as Ms. Whalen said, that this could very quickly be considered the standard of care when it's only an expiration date for a device.
Thank you. Dr. Brown?
I note that this, as pointed out by Mrs. Whalen, thank you, that this doesn't change. We already have the opportunity to have prescriptions at 2 years, but it does move out prescriptions that may not be advised for 2 years. And I don't believe in making rules for the sake of making rules. So I think that the current law accommodates what they're desiring and that we don't need new verbiage to lock that in.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brown. Other comments?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I agree with what's been said. I just had a question. What's behind this bill or who put this forth or how does something like this even come to be?
Margaret. I think that was
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Carpenter. The senator who is sponsoring the bill is the reason that the bill is here. He recently had the experience of going to his optometrist or the optician to get the refill on an eyeglass prescription and was told that it was expired and that it was a 1 year time frame and that he had to have a new eye exam and did not agree with that concept. So I hope I said that as politely as possible.
That's interesting. So one person can put that forth just because of their experience, huh? One person in power.
I had a couple comments I thought that I would make just stating for the record. One thing that I could see happening with this is if there was a 2 year expiration date on a prescription. Patients' prescriptions frequently change within a 2 year time period. And, I'll have patients come back even when they're at 10 months from having received their last prescription because sometimes they want to be checked before they go get glasses to see if anything has changed. But the patient who may go at year 1.5 after the date of their prescription, that kind of thing, may go to get glasses and then could actually find that the prescription does not quite work like it did when it was originally written, and then go back to see their doctor for a recheck, a no-charge recheck, and then they have to go back to the optical, and then they get a no-charge remake. And so there is some potential financial impact to the doctors and the optical, whoever's making the glasses, when this may perpetuate errors, and then there may be a greater remake and greater time spent, you know, kind of addressing those issues. Also, I think that what is probably missed, I would suggest that the overall arching point of having a 1 year expiration on glasses prescriptions is generally to drive the patient back into their doctor so that they have an eye exam at 1 year intervals. So there are plenty of people actually who 1 year exam is the standard of care. So people that have a higher risk of all sorts of things, they're set to come back on 1 year at 1 year intervals. And you would be surprised how often it's the glasses prescription that drives those people back into compliance with their doctor. And then we say, great. Yes, we'll do the glasses, but FYI, we have to do an exam and you need to be dilated. And this is part of the standard of care. Before I give you a glasses prescription, you need this as part of my responsibilities. And so those are things that I think are important and probably not immediately obvious to the legislator. And then Margaret, I will say that when it comes to pediatrics, you bring up an excellent point, because pediatrics compared to your general adult, compared to your geriatric patient, they have very different presentations and very different needs as far as whether it's the development of vision, the midlife and what the risks associated with that, and then later life and what the risks are associated with that. And so putting a blanket two-year expiration on this may very well throw off a lot of the follow-ups that patients keep with their doctor. And so I think it's a bigger issue. And I guess generally my position would be I would be opposed to this. So just for the record, that's my position.
This is Dr. Cohn, I have one more point to make, is that a lot of times the glasses almost act as a screening device that may motivate the patient to come in, that they may come in for the yearly exam because they want to renew glasses, and we may uncover a medical issue developing. So we lose half of our advance notice with this to be able to identify things that they may not associate, they may not be coming and complaining about, but the fact they want to update the glasses is what brought them in, but it may not be the issue they leave with.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. It serves as a patient protection, whether it's recognized or realized by lay people. I would say that it absolutely isn't. It's my opinion. Other comments from the board?
Yes, this is Dr. Koenigan. May I ask a question about that? If we respond, say we decide that we oppose it, can we put that in there as far as the explanation? I think you stated that well, that it acts as an opportunity to bring them in to be able to uncover other things.
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Cohen, you may make any comments that you wish on behalf of the board as a board member. So if you wanted to send me comments, I can certainly post those as part of our response, our position to the bill.
This is Dr. Mastoros. I agree with everything that's been said and vehemently think this is a terrible idea for the reasons stated prior, pediatrics, protecting them, as well as uncovering things like glaucoma, retinal tears, et cetera, that are blinding for people. I think we all of the doctors on this board have had cases where somebody went a little too long, they came back in 2 years and they have raging glaucoma or they have a retinal tear. So if our job as a board is to protect the public, then I believe that this is a very bad idea for patients. Thank you.
Okay. Other comments?
Mr. Hamad, you're muted.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Sorry about that. This is Sammy Hamad. I'd like to make a motion that we oppose Senate Bill 1075, I think.
1014.
It is. Oops, sorry, 1014. I apologize. That we oppose Kavanaugh's bill. And for the reasons as outlined by Mary Whalen, and as well as you all as well. And Mary, and Ms. Whalen, you can use her comments to compose as part of the opposition to Senator Kavanaugh's bill.
Thank you.
Dr. Mastoros, I'll second.
Any further discussion? Okay, so we'll vote. We have a motion to oppose, to take a position of opposition against SB 1014. Mr. Hamad, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoros?
Aye.
I also vote aye. So motion passes 7-0. And then just as a review, any comments that the board would like to put in writing to Margaret says that she could list those. That might be helpful. Agenda item L, review, discussion, and possible action regarding draft telehealth registration form for optometry. So we have a new telehealth form that was consistent with other telehealth forms for the state agencies, and this is for the new Authentia e-license system. It'll go on that platform. Were there any comments regarding the form? Any discussion?
Do we need to vote on it?
I believe we do, just to accept it.
Yes, please, if you would. Just as a formality, Dr. Brown, I would appreciate it.
I make a motion we accept it as presented.
Is there a second?
It's Dr. Cohn, I'll second.
Any further discussion? Okay. So we've had a motion and a second to accept the new telehealth form for the Authentia e-license system. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mesdores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Agenda item M, Executive Director's Report. Number one, budget. Margaret.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. Let me preempt my discussion by saying I will not be going through each of these bills individually today. That list is exhaustive, and we'll just get to that in a second. Let me start with the budget, as Dr. Moffitt stated. Pull up my notes here. So as a reminder, our fiscal year 23, which we are currently in, it ends June 30th. Appropriation is $298,800. As of December 31st, our beginning cash balance was $568,025 with an ending cash balance of $559,517. 41.66% of the fiscal year has elapsed, with the board spending at 39.05%. The agency will ask for permanent appropriation in this year's budget submission for fiscal year 24, with of $10,000 to cover salary increases that were given by the governor last year, and the $13,300 in statewide adjustments, which includes the WSSI student subsidies, our accounting system called AFIS, and our human resources information system called HRIS. Those fees and costs have unfortunately gone up and get passed on to the agencies. So those are payments that are required. So I will be asking for that.
Quick question.
Yes.
We still do WSSI?
We do.
Thank you.
Yes. If that's something that the board wants to have a discussion about, we can certainly add that as a future agenda item. So
I like it.
Okay. The Sunset Review Committee of Reference meeting, I did kind of touch on it earlier. The Committee of Reference is when the Senate and the House Health Committees come together. The co-chairs from each committee run the meeting, and that's where all of us who are up for renewal kind of, you know, appear and defend our position on behalf of our agencies, which I did. And, of course, as you know, we were given the green light to go ahead and move forward, and 6 years at the moment. And then the legislative council actually drafted our continuation bill, which is that 1075. The e-licensing update. We are moving to the Authentia platform, as you know, and that is going along swimmingly. We have an expected kickoff date of April or May, but I think Authentia is a little bit behind. So it's looking like possibly the middle to end of summer, I would say by August at the latest, which is totally fine with me. Because of the audit and some other issues that I've had a little more urgency to, I haven't been able to give as much time as I would like to dedicate to the Authentia programming. The programming is still going, but a lot of our letters, like our deficiency notice, our administratively complete letter, our notice to pay, all those letters are terribly outdated. And I want to make sure all the statutes are correct and all the rules are correct, because we cite everything in there, you know, as far as fees and things like that. So I do want to dedicate time to that. So, but I think it's going to be a great platform, and we're working, you know, hard on it. We have weekly meetings. I have weekly meetings with the people from Authentia, and I also did contract with Gould Intelligence, which is a local company of programmers, and they are helping us because I'm not a programmer, so I don't know. They could tell me anything I probably wouldn't really know. So in order to protect the agency and me from getting, you know, kind of bamboozled, if you will, just in the event that Authentia was not an honest company, which they are, Gould Intelligence has been very helpful. So that's money well spent, I assure you. The annual conflict of interest forms, statements, I've received a few back, probably about half the board, but if you could make that a priority, that was one of our audit findings. So I did put into policy, as you recall, and the form is there, on or around January 1st of every calendar year. So I did kind of tell the auditors that that would coincide with whatever our first meeting of the year was. So if you would make that a priority and just, it's an online fillable form. So when you pull up the PDF, you can check the boxes and electronically sign if you wish, or you can print it and sign it. I don't need the form, of course, and you don't have to print that, but, if you would at least send the, form back, that is to be in compliance with one of the audit findings. Item five, the board member training. I have looked at CLEAR, which I totally forgot to pull up. Let me, they do have a, five-part module for, board member training that starts February 23rd. It's virtual. It's 1 hour a month. And, the cost to send all of you, virtually is $1,200. But I think it would, definitely meet the requirement of the auditors, as far as the board member training and, I think that the board should consider taking the course. Let me pull it up. I'm so sorry. I meant to do that earlier.
I strongly agree, Margaret. 1 hour a month is absolutely doable, and if we can do it virtually, I think that's
great. It's definitely virtual. Oh my gosh, really? I was working on it last night. Now I'm trying to find. So sorry. Hold on 1 second, everybody. I just wanted you to see the modules because I think, it's going to be a good course. Here we go. Okay. I'm going to share my screen again real quick so you can see the modules. Can everybody see these modules right here? So this is called Introduction to Regulatory Governance. It's the module webinar series. Here are the five different modules that are included. As you can see, Foundations of Occupational and Professional Regulation, Roles and Responsibilities of a Board Member, Administrative Rulemaking, Professional Discipline, and Addressing Competence. So I think that's a good start as far as training goes. And, Ms. Baskin has always been gracious and, you know, provides conflict of interest training. She has, she has a memo to the board, the legislative memo, that should help with all the conflict of interest information. I don't know, Ms. Baskin, if you want to kind of speak on your, memo there. I'll stop sharing so you can see the board members.
Good morning, Dr. Moffitt, members of the board, Mona Baskin here on behalf of the Arizona Attorney General's Office. As you have in your packet, you have a conflict of interest memo that is quite detailed. I went ahead and I also included the various statutes at the end that I thought were pertinent to your training. Just very briefly to touch on some of the topics that are within the memo. The memo lays out that the purpose of the conflict of interest laws is to ensure impartiality by the board. I've included some case law in there, and it's Arizona case law states that what the conflict of interest laws are focused on are to prevent any self-dealing by public officers. And these are very broad statutes that apply to across the board to public officers. One case states that one cannot serve two masters with conflicting interest, and public officers should avoid situations where their professional or financial concerns might conflict with their unbiased performance of their duties. So as a board member, you're a member of the board. You act as a board at the board meeting. You review the cases, not only the cases, but all the information that is presented to you, whether it's a CE approving a site for taking the jurisprudence exam, all those decisions need to be made independent without any outside influence, either personal or financial. And so that is a very important function of the board. If you want to take a look at the definition of substantial interest, that's included in the memo, and I've listed on pages 2 and 3. It's quite detailed also within the statutes. A board member who has or has a relative who has a substantial interest in any decision of a board has a conflict of interest as defined by law. And at that time, you would need to recuse yourself from any participation and clearly state what that interest is on the record. So, for example, if there's a national optometric firm and you are an employee of that and there's a complaint against that firm, clearly that's an example of a conflict of interest that would have to be disclosed. The statute requires that board members who do have a conflict of interest make that interest known. And that would be by filing a paper, which is signed by the public officer employee, which fully discloses a substantial interest to both the public and to the board. As far as official records, that is very broadly defined as minutes or papers, records, documents maintained by the public agency. And Margaret has come up with a form that does satisfy that requirement. So I think that part is very clear. If the board ever has any questions about whether or not they have a conflict of interest under the statute, that is something that you can consult with both myself and Ms. Whalen. If you do have a conflict of interest, you may not participate in any consideration, discussion, or decision-making on that matter. You should not review any of the information, confidential information. You should completely step aside from any type of consideration on that issue. And again, it's not only a case. It could be decisions about CE. You know, it could be something that has to do with the testing centers, with people that you may know or that you have a relative. I've also included bias, prejudice, and predetermination. And that may be and that's pretty much laid out in the memo. But if you have some type of personal bias or predetermination on the case that you cannot get past, and board members, this comes up from time to time. This is another time when you would need to go ahead and step aside from considering the case. And then finally, the appearance of impropriety. And this is even if a board member believes that you do not have any actual bias or prejudice, there may be the optics of the situation where you would need to consider. And of course, this is a fact-specific situation that you may want to not participate to avoid the appearance of any type of impropriety. And that could be, again, based on the nexus of your relationship with the matter that is before the board. And again, it's very fact specific. So for example, you could be serving on a committee with an individual or a company, and based on your relationship on that committee or that other board, it creates the appearance of any type of impropriety. You may, as a board member, say that, you know, the optics on this, I do not want to create any appearance of bias and to step away from the board's consideration of that. When you do make a determination and you do recuse yourself, pardon me, you would need to, again, provide that in writing to Ms. Whalen. And if it's an in-person board meeting, then that member would need to step away from the board table announce it prior to, as Ms. Whalen has on the agenda, to state any conflicts of interest early on the agenda and step away and sit in the audience during the consideration of it. If we are virtually on the computer, then that member would need to turn off their audio and turn off their camera during consideration of that matter. I did include a little bit of ex parte communication, and this would be, I think Ms. Galan has served on boards before, so she's aware of this, and so do the other board members. But just as a refresher, this is related to like the issue of bias and prejudgment. The board members, once you get on the board, many times licensees will reach out to contact you and say, hey, can you answer this question about CE or, you know, or an issue about a complaint? If there's any type of communication with you at that point, it should cease and you should not interact. And that information should be directed to Ms. Whalen. And obviously you can politely explain that, pardon me, as a board member, you are unable to participate in any of those discussions, and the board speaks as a whole at the board meeting, and there are no side communications. So with that, I will answer any questions, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Maskin. I have had people reach out to me before, actually, so that does happen. Message at work from one of the complainants before, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And any other comments, Madam President, members of the board? Thank you so much, Ms. Baskin. Amazing as always.
Thank you.
So legislative session, I promised I wouldn't regale you with all the bills, but I do want to let you know that this year is the 56th legislature first regular session. It began Monday, January 9th, 2023. Today is day 26 of session. To date, 1,328 bills have been introduced, 609 in the House and 719 in the Senate. Most of the bills that are listed on the agenda, of course, as you can see, are health regulatory boards. I think it's important for us to, as a board, to see what other professions are experiencing, some of the challenges they may have, some of the bills that get introduced for their professions. Some of these are bills that affect all of us as a whole, the health regulatory boards. There was a couple about meetings. Let's see, where is it? open meetings capacity. I think some of that was driven during pandemic, but somehow I think that the legislators feel that we either are not creating enough room for members of the public to come in. As you know, historically, our board doesn't have a lot of attendance at its meetings, but some of the bigger boards like dental, nursing, medical do have lots of members of the public. So I think that bill kind of addresses capacity limits or availability of other rooms and virtual means. So again, these are all the bill numbers. You can certainly go and look at them. I will be going through in a little more detail at our next meeting. The reason I'm not today is also because it is only day 26 and most of the bills on this list have only had a second read in their House of Origin or their Chamber of Origin, excuse me. And so there's nothing to really report. A lot of the titles are very good, so you can kind of see what the bill is without having to read the whole actual bill. But I do encourage you, if anything interests you or if you hear of anything that isn't on my list, to please let me know, because sometimes what we see in other professions makes its way around to our profession, as well as, you know, kind of the general statutes that govern all the health regulatory boards. So did anybody have an immediate question about any of the bills on the list? I can certainly give you a status update. I do have my status updates for all of them if you wanted to hear about a specific bill. Okay, perfect. Item number 7, future agenda items. Is there anything that any of you would like to see on a future agenda item for discussion?
Just follow up on the CLEAR training. That's what I would say. I think we definitely want that set up and structured so that we can start participating.
Okay. That course does start in February, so I probably will just get you signed up if that's, you know, if the board is looking to do that, which I may or may not give you a choice kind of a thing.
No, I think we have to do
choice.
It.
Your board. Pardon?
I think we have to do it.
I mean, ideally, yes. I'm sure that they will start another training probably in June. So this is probably like the first half of the year. I didn't see it on their events list. So if you wanted to wait, Dr. Moffitt and members of the board, we certainly could do that. I mean, it's kind of an administrative function. So if you don't mind, I can just get us signed up and you all can attend the first half of the year here, or we can wait and see if it's offered the second half of the year.
I vote that we do it now. That would be my suggestion. We have new board members. I think we should just tackle this. Okay. Other board members?
Dr. Brown, I'm anxious to take it, looking forward to it. Can you get us a link to the site and dates so we can start adjusting our schedules, please?
Yes, I will do that. And just for the record, it was not an official vote by Dr. Moffitt.
Yes, sorry.
That is vernacular.
My opinion. Yes.
No worries. Okay, well, I appreciate that small feedback, so I will based on our other agenda item where I had talked about the board member training under number 5, M5, I will go ahead and schedule everybody and hopefully you'll be able to take that course. And then it should give you a certificate, which you can submit to the board at some point in time so that we have proof of your attendance. That'd be perfect.
Okay. Can I follow that up, Margaret? For the other board members, I just want to make sure that they understand, like, this is mandatory training. We have to do this training, and this is a structured way in which we can do it virtually. We have a time frame in which we can take it, so it offers a lot of convenience for us individually and satisfies these requirements, as opposed to even potentially having to have meetings where we have to sit and train during the meeting. This is something that we can do on our own time, and so I think it's an attractive form of training that's been made available to us.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Moffitt. And members of the board, also, anytime Ms. Baskin presents does count towards board training. So I very much appreciate that because she always is giving of her time and her intelligence to keep us informed. So that also counts as time towards board training. So we're very lucky. So we have that. And then I think the CLEAR course will be excellent for all of you. Okay, so are there any future, there are future board meeting dates. What are the future board meeting dates? I actually would ask the board for next month, Friday, March 3rd at 8 a.m. I have two complaints that were received just prior to this meeting, so they could not be on this meeting. I'll have 10 applicants, I believe, who may need to be approved by the board under ARS 327030 due to the fingerprinting. And I have a few more testing centers, but again, it should be a smaller agenda, kind of like today. So does March 3rd, is there availability for all of you?
March 3rd is fine with me. Is the 8 a.m. Yes. time still preferred by everybody?
It is for me.
Okay.
I like it.
Okay. Dr. Cohen?
Yes, Dr. Cohen, I agree.
Okay. Ms. Galan, 8?
I can do 8.
Okay. And Mr. Hamed?
Yeah, I can do 8 as well.
Okay. Great.
I can.
And then, yeah, the 3rd? March the 3rd or
whatever. Yes, please. Friday, March 3rd, first Friday of the month. Ms. Baskin, is your availability clear?
Yes, I already put it in my schedule. Yes, and 8 a.m. Thank you.
Okay, so to be clear for the record, our next meeting will be Friday, March 3rd at 8 a.m., virtual via Zoom as it was today. And then I expect that we will have probably just one more meeting. That was something I wanted to tell you. We've had 5 meetings this fiscal year, including this one. As you recall, we're mandated to meet 6 times per year, so we're doing good as far as our schedule goes for meetings, so. I appreciate that. Okay, so March 3rd. So then we would probably be looking at May as the final board meeting for this fiscal year, unless, you know, board business dictates another meeting. Okay. And that date would be, just so you have a tentative, May 5th, Friday, May 5th.
Cinco de Mayo.
Yes. So we will get our business done early in the morning, so you have the rest of your day. That concludes my executive director's report, Madam President, and members of the board. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Agenda item N, call to the public. Are there any members of the public that would like to address the board? Okay, I hear no comments. Agenda item O, motion to adjourn. Would anyone like to move to adjourn the meeting?
No.
So,
Dr. Brown, was that you or Dr. Cohen first?
This is Dr. Cohen. I was just joking. I move to adjourn today's meeting.
Is there a second?
Dr. Brown, second.
Any further discussion? Okay. We'll vote. We've got a motion to adjourn the meeting. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye, and I'd like to say it's a very well-researched, well-run meeting. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Dr. Mazdouras?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 7-0. This Arizona State Board of Optometry meeting is adjourned at 9:28.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you all. See you next month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.